Tervetuloa Selman Kari Luoman väitöstilaisuuteen. Welcome to the public examination of Selman Kari Luoman's dissertation, Co-constructing recovery in suicidal crisis, service users' perspectives on healthcare and crisis services after a suicidal attempt. The opponent is Professor Eugenia Keokaka, Aristotle University, Thessaloniki, Greece. As a custos appointed by the faculty, I declare this public examination opened.
Arvoisa kustos, kunnioitettu vastaväittäjä, hyvät kuulijat. Vuosina 1986–1996 Suomessa toteutettiin kunnianhimoinen itsemurhien ehkäisyohjelma. Vuodesta 1990 itsemurhien määrä on Suomessa vähentynyt puoleen. Muutos kertoo siitä, että itsemurhien määrään on mahdollista vaikuttaa. Viime vuosina toteutuneiden itsemurhien määrä on Suomessa pysynyt tasaisena. On kuitenkin viitteitä siitä, että muiden kuin kuolemaan johtavien itsetuhoisten tekojen, siis esimerkiksi itsemurhayritysten, määrä on lisääntynyt pikemmin kuin vähentynyt. Tarve sekä itsetuhoisuutta ehkäiseville toimille että itsetuhoisuuden hoitoon liittyvien palveluiden kehittämiselle säilyy. Toimien pohjaksi tarvitaan moninäkökulmaista ja monimenetelmäistä tutkimusta, myös paikallisesti Suomesta. Väitöstutkimuksessani selvitin itsemurhaa yrittäneiden omia näkemyksiä heidän itsemurhakriisin aikana saamistaan ja tarvitsemistaan palveluista. Tutkimus tarkasteli osallistujien kokemuksia itsemurhayritystä välittömästi seuraavista viikoista ja kuukausista. Itsetuhoisten tekojen ehkäisyn kannalta tuo aika on erityisen tärkeää. Samaan aikaan, kun siihen liittyy erityisen korkea uusien itsetuhoisten tekojen vaara, se on myös täynnä mahdollisuuksia. Suurin osa itsemurhaa yrittäneistä ei kuole itsemurhan kautta. Jopa pitkään ja vaikeasta itsetuhoisuudesta kärsineistä suuri osa toipuu elämään hyvää elämää. Niin kauan kuin elämä jatkuu, se voi alkaa tuntua elämisen arvoiselta. Itsemurhayrityksen jälkeen saadun hoidon laatu ja sisällöt vaikuttavat uusien itsetuhoisten tekojen määrään tässä haavoittuvassa ryhmässä. Sillä, miten palvelujärjestelmä itsetuhoiseen kriisiin vastaa, on merkitystä. Mutta millaisia vastauksia palvelunkäyttäjät itse palvelujärjestelmältä toivovat? Entä miltä näyttävät sen nykyiset vastaukset palvelunkäyttäjien silmi? Sitä halusin paremmin ymmärtää. Tutkimusta varten syvähaastattelin 14 itsemurhaa yrittänyttä täysi-ikäistä pääkaupunkiseudun asukasta. Kaikki tutkimuksen osallistujat olivat osallistuneet Mieli ry:n lyhytintervention itsemurhaa yrittäneille, eli Linityyn. Kaikilla oli kokemusta myös terveyspalveluista. Itsetuhoisen kriisinsä aikana he olivat asioineet esimerkiksi opiskelija- ja työterveyshuollossa, terveysasemilla, päivystyksessä ja psykiatrisessa avohoidossa. Osa oli ollut myös osastohoidossa itsemurhayrityksen somaattisten seurausten, psyykkisen vointinsa tai molempien vuoksi. Mukana tutkimuksessa oli sekä mielenterveyspalveluiden ensikertalaisia että paljon palveluita käyttäneitä. Ensi kertaa itsemurhaa yrittäneitä ja useampia aiempia itsemurhayrityksiä tehneitä. Vakavista ja pitkäaikaisista mielenterveysongelmista kärsineitä ja elämässään nykyisen kriisin ulkopuolella pääosin hyvinvoineita ihmisiä. Iältään osallistujat olivat juuri täysi-ikäistyneistä ikääntyneisiin ja sukupuolten jakauma oli tasainen. Tutkimuksen osallistujat edustivat siis monipuolisesti itsemurhaa yrittäneiden moninaista joukkoa. Heidän kertomuksensa muodostivat väitöstutkimukseni aineiston. Tänään tarkastettava väitöskirja koostuu kolmesta osatutkimuksesta ja yhteenveto-osiosta, jonka tarkoituksena on yhdistää osatutkimusten aineistosta tuottamaa ymmärrystä. Ensimmäisessä osatutkimuksessa tarkasteltiin sitä, miten itsemurhaa yrittäneet olivat kokeneet terveyspalveluiden auttaneen tai joskus myös haitanneen toipumistaan. Kansainvälisesti palvelunkäyttäjien näkökulmaa selvittävät tutkimukset ovat tällä vuosituhannella lisääntyneet, mutta itsemurhaa yrittäneiden suomalaisten aikuisten palvelukokemuksista ei ollut aiempaa laadullista tutkimustietoa. Kaikilla osallistujilla oli kokemusta auttaviksi koetuista kohtaamisista. Useimmilla oli kokemusta myös hyödyttömäksi tai jopa haitalliseksi koetusta vuorovaikutuksesta palveluiden kanssa. Monet hoitoa koskevat toiveet olivat osallistujille yhteisiä. Katso ja kohtele minua avun arvoisena. Auta minua tutkimaan itsetuhoista tekoani. Huolehdi, ettei kannatteleva yhteys palveluihin kokonaan katkea hoidon siirtymäkohdissakaan. Ota minut mukaan lääkehoitoani koskeviin päätöksiin. Ota huomioon myös minulle tärkeät ihmiset ja ihmissuhteet tai niiden puute. Tarjoa apua juuri niihin ongelmiin, joihin etsin ratkaisua itsetuhoisesta teostani. Kun nämä toiveet toteutuivat, toivo ja toimintamahdollisuudet lisääntyivät. Kun ne jäivät täyttymättä, toivottomuuden ja avuttomuuden kokemukset valtasivat alaa. Toisessa osatutkimuksessa tarkasteltiin osallistujien näkemyksiä siitä, miten Mieli ry:n kautta tarjottuun lyhytinterventioon itsemurhaa yrittäneille, eli Linityyn, osallistuminen oli vaikuttanut heihin. Linity on yksi useista itsetuhoiseen toimintaan kohdennetuista lyhytinterventioista, joita viimeisen reilun vuosikymmenen aikana on kehitetty. Lyhytinterventioiden vaikuttavuutta itsetuhoisten tekojen vähentämisessä on tutkittu määrällisin menetelmin. Käyttäjien näkökulmaa valottavaa laadullista tutkimusta niistä on kuitenkin kansainvälisestikin hyvin niukasti. Lyhytinterventioiden kasvavan suosion taustalla on toisaalta paine saada niukat terveydenhuollon resurssit riittämään mahdollisimman suurelle määrälle apua tarvitsevia. Itsetuhoisuuteen kohdennettujen lyhytinterventioiden kehittäjät kuitenkin korostavat, että lyhytinterventioita ei ole suunniteltu korvaamaan, vaan täydentämään muuta tarpeenmukaista hoitoa itsemurhayrityksen jälkeen. Resurssipaineiden lisäksi itsetuhoisuuteen fokusoitujen lyhytinterventioiden kehittämistä ovat motivoineet havainnot itsemurhaa yrittäneiden ja itsemurhavaarassa olevien palvelukäyttäytymisestä. Itsetuhoisuudesta kärsivien on nimittäin havaittu vetäytyvän usein nopeasti hoidosta. Siksi ne kohtaamiset, joita käytettävissä on syytä käyttää tehokkaasti. Tavoitteena on sekä vähentää itsetuhoisen teon riskiä tässä ja nyt, että vahvistaa sitoutumista muihin tarvittaviin palveluihin. Sekä uusien itsetuhoisten tekojen vähentämisessä, niiden riskin vähentämisessä, että hoitoon sitoutumisen vahvistamisessa, Linity onnistui tutkimukseen osallistuneiden mielestä hyvin. Linityn työntekijöiden vilpittömän kiinnostuneeksi ja myötätuntoiseksi koettu suhtautuminen oli tuottanut helpotuksen ja toiveikkuuden kokemuksia. Itsemurhayrityksen huolellinen läpikäyminen oli mahdollistanut uuden ymmärryksen syntymistä ja auttanut jäsentämään, millaisia muutoksia uuden itsemurhayrityksen välttäminen edellyttää. Linityssä rakennettu turvasuunnitelma sekä tieto Linityyn kuuluvasta kirjaseurannasta ja yhteydenottomahdollisuudesta loivat turvallisuuden tunnetta. Linityn jälkeen osallistujat olivat motivoituneet jatkamaan toipumisen eteen työskentelyä palveluiden avulla. Kun palvelupolku jatkui Linityn jälkeen riittävän ennakoitavana, osallistujat kokivat rakentavansa jo hyvin käynnistyneen muutoksen päälle. Palvelujärjestelmä ei kuitenkaan johdonmukaisesti onnistunut Linityssä virinneen toivon ja työskentelymotivaation hyödyntämisessä. Haastattelut toteutuivat 4-10 viikkoa viimeisen Linitykäynnin jälkeen. Haastatteluhetkellä puolet osallistujista kuvasi olevansa ikään kuin hoidon välitilassa, epätietoisena palveluiden jatkumisesta. Vaikka useimmilla heistä oli hoitosuhde psykiatriseen erikoissairaanhoitoon, se ei aina taannut varsinaista hoitoa. Jos tarvittavaa tukea käynnistyneen muutoksen eteen työskentelemiseen ei Linityn jälkeen ollut tarjolla, saavutetut hyödyt ja syntynyt toivo alkoivat hiipua. Katkeleville palvelupoluille hukattiin siis resursseja ja tehdyn työn hedelmiä. Kolmannessa osatutkimuksessa tarkastelimme osallistujien oman toipumiseen liittyvän toimijuuden rakentumista yhteydessä heidän palveluista saamaansa tukeen. Toimijuuden käsite tarjosi hyödyllisen linssin sekä osallistujien itsetuhoisen käyttäytymisen että heidän toipumiseen liittyvien ponnistustensa tarkasteluun. Toimijuus on kykyä vaikuttaa itseen ja ympäristöön omien intentioiden eli aikomusten mukaisesti. Toimijuuden menettäessään ihminen kokee olevansa voimaton ja olosuhteiden armoilla. Itsetuhoisten tekojen ehkäisemisessä ihmisen omalla toimijuudella on keskeinen merkitys. Osallistujien kertomuksissa toipumiseen liittyvä toimijuus kuvautui muuttuvana ja suhteessa elävänä ilmiönä, jonka saavuttamisessa ja ylläpitämisessä palveluista saadulla tuella oli ratkaiseva merkitys. Ammattilaisilta saatu tuki toi myös ratkaisevaa turvaa silloin, kun toimijuus oli hetkellisesti menetetty. Kertomukset tekivät näkyväksi, miten monenlaisilla tavoilla kaikki osallistujat olivat ilmaisseet toipumiseen liittyvää toimijuutta itsemurhakriisinsä keskelläkin, ja miten monenlaisilla tavoilla ammattilaiset saattoivat olla näille pyrkimyksille ratkaisevaksi avuksi tai jopa haitaksi. Yhdessä osatutkimusten tulokset haastavat palvelujärjestelmää huomioimaan paremmin palvelunkäyttäjien oman toimijuuden, heille tärkeät suhteet ja palvelupolkujen jatkuvuuden. Väitöskirjani kolme keskeistä väitettä kuuluvat näin. 1. Hoidon jäykän yksilökeskeiseksi koettu ote ei vastaa palvelunkäyttäjien toiveita ja tarpeita. Itsetuhoisuudesta kärsivien hoidossa tulisi paremmin huomioida heidän ihmissuhteensa ja niiden vahvistamiseen kohdennetun tuen tarjoaminen. Myös suoraan läheisille tarjottu tuki on itsetuhoisuudesta kärsivien näkökulmasta tärkeä. 2. Itsetuhoisuuteen fokusoidut lyhytinterventiot ovat tärkeä osa palveluvalikoimaa ja niiden saatavuutta tulisi lisätä. Se ei kuitenkaan yksin riitä, vaan on panostettava myös palvelupolun psykologiseen ennakoitavuuteen ja jatkuvuuteen lyhytinterventioiden ympärillä, jotta niissä saavutetut hyödyt eivät valu hukkaan. 3. Itsetuhoisuudesta kärsivän oma toimijuus tulee ymmärtää sekä hoitotoimenpiteiden ensisijaiseksi kohteeksi että niiden keskeiseksi resurssiksi. Ammattilaisten on osattava auttaa muodostamaan toipumista koskevia aikomuksia ja vahvistamaan kyvykkyyttä toteuttaa niitä. Se edellyttää palvelunkäyttäjän näkökulman nostamista hoidon keskiöön. Näiden väitteiden lisäksi pohdin väitöskirjassani tieteellisten paradigmojen, tieteenalojen ja ammattiryhmien välisiä suhteita itsemurhatutkimuksessa ja suomalaisessa terveydenhuollossa. Millainen tieto otetaan huomioon, kun itsetuhoisten tekojen ehkäisemiseen tarkoitettuja palveluita kehitetään? Mikä on palvelunkäyttäjien oman äänen merkitys? Entä miten tulevat hyödynnetyiksi lääketieteen, hoitotieteen, psykologiatieteen ja sosiaalitieteiden erilaisten näkökulmien mahdollisuus täydentää toisiaan? Väitän, etteivät riittävästi. Mielenterveyspalveluiden kehittämisessä ja johtamisessa lääketieteellistä näkökulmaa tulisi nähdäkseni nykyistä vahvemmin tasapainottaa muiden sote-tieteen alojen näkökulmilla. Silloinkin ja kenties erityisesti silloin, kun näiden eri tieteen alojen perusoletukset ja näkökulmat ovat jännitteisessä suhteessa toisiinsa. Palvelunkäyttäjien näkökulmalle ja psykologiatieteelle ajattelen tarvittavan päätöksenteossa huomattavasti lisää painoarvoa kaikkialla siellä, missä ymmärrys motivaatiosta inhimillisen toiminnan perustana, psyykkisen muutoksen rakentumisesta ja vuorovaikutuksen merkityksestä sekä motivaatiolle että muutokselle ovat hoitotuloksen kannalta kriittisiä. Työtä riittää meille kaikille. Ja sillä työllä on merkitystä. Eräs sekä useampia itsetuhoisia kriisejä että niiden väliin mahtuneita hyviä aikoja elämässään kokenut osallistuja kuvasi saamansa avun merkitystä näin. Mä oon aina kuvannut sitä itsetuhoisuutta, jonka sellaisessa keskipisteessä on se kuoleman valitseminen, että se on kuin gravitaatiokenttä, johon sä tavallaan imeydyt sitä kuoleman valitsemisen pistettä kohti. Niin sitten jokainen askel, jonka sä pääset sieltä pisteestä poispäin, niin on ratkaisevaa. Jokainen askel elämää kohti on ratkaisevaa. Terveys- ja kriisipalvelut voivat auttaa askelmerkkien löytämisessä ja askelten ottamisessa. Näille palveluille osoitetuilla resursseilla ja niiden johtamisella taas on merkitystä sille, millaista apua niistä löytyy. Itsemurhaa yrittäneen tai itsetuhoisessa kriisissä olevan ihmisen auttaminen on emotionaalisesti vaativaa työtä. Ammattilaisten oma psyykkisen suojautumisen tarve voi näyttäytyä välttelevänä, vähättelevänä tai pakottavana vuorovaikutuksena, jollaisesta myös tämän tutkimuksen osallistujilla oli toisinaan kokemusta. Palvelun käyttäjillä on oikeus odottaa, että ammattilainen jaksaa ottaa vastaan ne vaikeat kokemukset, joiden kanssa he palveluita lähestyvät. On meidän ammattilaisten ja työmme reunaehdoista päättävien poliittisten johtajien yhteinen vastuu huolehtia, että ammattilaisten kyky tähän vastaanottamiseen säilyy. Käytännössä laadukkaan hoidon johdonmukainen toteutuminen edellyttää, että kaikilla itsetuhoisuudesta kärsiviä ihmisiä kohtaavilla ammattilaisilla on riittävä koulutus työn emotionaalisten ja vuorovaikutukseen liittyvien haasteiden tunnistamiseen, mahdollisuus työryhmän ja työnohjauksen tukeen vaativissa tilanteissa sekä riittävä työrauha. Niiden turvaaminen vaatii mielenterveystyölle riittäviä resursseja. On tarpeen muistuttaa päättäjiä siitä, että itsetuhoisten tekojen määrään voidaan poliittisella päätöksenteolla vaikuttaa. Valtiojohdon ymmärrystä näistä mahdollisuuksista heijasti mielenterveysstrategian yhteydessä julkaistu itsemurhien ehkäisyohjelma vuosille 2020–2030. Se sisältää toimenpideehdotuksia sekä itsetuhoisuutta väestötasolla vähentävistä että itsetuhoisuuden hoitoa vahvistavista toimista. Tällä hetkellä ohjelman toteuttamiselta puuttuu kuitenkin riittävä ja riittävän ennakoitava rahoitus. Suomessa itsemurheen ehkäisytyötä on perinteisesti tehty laajassa julkisen sektorin ja järjestöjen yhteistyössä. Sote-järjestöt kantavat merkittävää roolia itsetuhoisuudesta kärsivien ja heidän läheistensä tukemisessa. Nyt järjestöjen rahoitukseen kohdistuvat leikkaukset ovat kuitenkin johtamassa niiden toiminnan huomattavaan supistumiseen. Samaan aikaan psykiatrinen erikoissairaanhoito on Suomessa pitkäaikaisesti alirahoitettu, eikä tilanteen korjaamiseen ole poliittisessa päätöksenteossa tartuttu. Työ on siis kesken ja se jatkuu. Vaikka kehittämistä riittää, myös toivo on vahvasti läsnä. Itsetuhoisuudesta voi toipua. Siitä kärsivää voi auttaa. Tutkimushaastatteluissa tuli esiin monenlaisia tarpeita ja mahdollisuuksia nykyisten palveluiden vahvistamiseen. Samalla esiin piirtyi kuitenkin toinen, aivan yhtä tärkeä todellisuus. Apua oli saatu ja elämä oli saanut jatkua. Honored professor, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, please present the comments that you see my dissertation has given grounds for.
Is it on? Dear Kustos. Dear members of the Faculty of Psychology, dear doctoral candidate, dear ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I would like to thank the Faculty of Psychology for inviting me to examine Selma Kelly Luoma's thesis, and particularly Professors Arno Laitila and Juha Holma, who have helped me through the process. I have a long-standing contact with colleagues at the School of Psychology of the University of Jyväskylä. I have been following the work you have been doing here on topics of clinical psychology and psychotherapy and have been impressed with how systematic and how innovative this work is. I have visited Jyväskylä before, a few years ago, and I'm pleased to be here again to see colleagues and to keep in touch with the developments in research and clinical training that take place here and which are always an inspiration for me. I am very happy to act as opponent in the oral examination of Selma Gailey Luoma's thesis. I had the opportunity to engage with it as pre-examiner and thus to appreciate the quality of her research project. In all, Ms. Selma Gailey Luoma's thesis is original, well-written, and engaging. The dissertation explores the subjective views and experiences of persons using a suicide prevention service regarding the healthcare services they have received. As such, it belongs to the growing trend of suicidology research, which is particularly developed in Finland. Although there has been extensive research, both internationally and in Finland, on the epidemiology and risk factors of suicidal behavior, as well as on the effectiveness of suicide treatment and prevention programs, most of the studies have been guided by the dominant evidence-based medicine paradigm, neglecting the views and perspectives of service users. Although internationally the inclusion of service users' perspective in healthcare services planning, evaluation, and delivery is gaining ground, it seems that in the field of suicide prevention, and especially in Finland, research is very limited. In this sense, this doctoral research that focuses on suicide attempt survivors' experiences and views of their healthcare treatment is important and innovative. It generates new and valuable knowledge for the development of effective and user-friendly suicide prevention services that address service users' needs and concerns. In terms of my own positioning with regard to this research, I am familiar with suicidology, but not an expert in it. My work focuses on the severe mental disorders seen from a clinical psychosocial perspective and on the development of recovery-oriented mental health services that are responsive to service users' needs and goals, using mainly qualitative research. Reading through the thesis, I found a lot of similarities between the field of suicide prevention that is studied here and trends in the field of mental health service provision generally. I will draw upon this background knowledge when I comment on Selma's work later. The thesis makes use of all the advantages of qualitative research on the effectiveness of clinical and psychosocial interventions. It prioritizes, respects, and highlights service users' perspectives, and it investigates the interactional processes that are involved in meaning-making and in shaping mental and social reality. The strength of the thesis, in my view, is showing how recovery is co-constructed in the context of suicide crisis services between suicide survivors and professionals. The thesis demonstrates the relational co-construction of recovery in two senses. Firstly, how the recovery of suicide survivors is promoted through collaborative processes in the context of services and interventions. And secondly, how the meaning of recovery from a suicide attempt and the reasons for the suicide attempt are constructed in the therapeutic interactions. This, of course, stresses the role of services and professionals in recovery, and the findings of this doctoral research may lead to very specific suggestions about the ways in which professional interventions can become recovery-oriented. The other strength of the study is related to your genuinely reflexive engagement with your doctoral work and the frankness with which you depict your personal motivations, thoughts, and aims as a mental health professional and as a researcher. In this work, I find some of the best examples of reflexive analysis that avoids the confessional mode of simply noting one's personal input, but really weaves yourself in its various roles and dimensions into the design, execution, and writing up of the study. Moreover, this is done in a very thoughtful and engaging way. The strengths of the thesis that I described before, at the same time, bring to the fore tensions and open up issues for debate. In fact, most of the issues I would like to discuss with a candidate in the oral examination center around them. Before we begin our discussion, I would like to suggest that in the examination we address each other in first name terms. I hope this will help create a setting more conducive to dialogue and is also in line with the egalitarian values that for me are very characteristic of the Finnish way of doing things. So let us begin the discussion. So, starting from the introduction of the theoretical background, I would like to commend you on the comprehensive, well-structured, and clearly presented overview of suicidology research, and specifically suicide prevention interventions and research, both internationally and within Finland. Indeed, the sheer amount of research on suicide, as well as the long-standing national programs and initiatives to develop prevention and intervention efforts, make finding a topic for original research on suicide prevention in Finland rather difficult. On the other hand, the scarcity of qualitative research on the perspectives of service of suicide survivors is staggering. This, of course, creates ample space for your study and makes your argument for the usefulness of qualitative studies even more important. I find this lack of qualitative studies surprising, given the emphasis on qualitative care, recovery-oriented models of practice, developing trusting and respectful care relationships, and prioritizing service users' perspectives that characterizes mental health service delivery worldwide, including suicide prevention. On the other hand, it can be explained, as you do when discussing the findings of this study, through the continuing dominance of the medical model and corresponding positivist research. So I would like to ask you, is the scarcity of qualitative research on suicide an international phenomenon or specific to the Finnish context? And could you elaborate a bit more on what you think are the most likely explanations for it?
Thank you for that question. I will try to make a concise answer to it. I think internationally, it has been an international phenomenon as well, but I think internationally there has been in the last maybe 20 years a fairly rapid accumulation of qualitative research on suicide prevention, and maybe in Finland we're lagging a little bit behind that. Of course, there was 2 years ago a doctoral thesis published on the experiences, service experiences or service expectations of suicidal adolescents and their parents. So I'm not the first one to this ball in Finland either. But I do think that there are, for example, in the UK, they are a little bit ahead of us in this sense. Also, I think that there have been a few qualitative research pieces on suicidal behavior in Finland back during the suicide prevention program in the 90s, but those were not so much focused on the interactions between suicidal service users and services, but rather on the suicidal experience, which is, of course, very valuable, and perhaps that's something that's also has been going on in suicide research more widely, that there has been a focus first on trying to understand the suicidal experience as it happens inside the person, and then there's a shift in emphasis towards how that is constructed actually between people or in relationships. You wanted reasons also, I now remember. let's see if I can give you reasons. Well, I do think that suicide prevention, there is also kind of a particular, because of the risks associated with suicidal behavior, there has perhaps been more of a need to cling to the certainty that in some instances the idea of there being this kind of way of classifying and then treating, kind of objecting these diagnosable classes to treatments that have been proven to be effective for those conditions, that it's maybe a little bit harder to let go of that idea in when there is the risk of suicide associated with this situation, that I think perhaps that is why the recovery-oriented ideas have maybe gained more ground or gained ground faster in other fields of mental health. So yes, I do think that we are holding on in suicide prevention. We are more holding on to the idea that maybe a fantasy that we can have the same kind of medical cures for these states as we can have for some other conditions outside of the field of mental health. And I think it's not only doctors that hold on to this hope. I think we are, many of us psychologists and other professions and lay people also kind of look at the medical profession with great hopes for assessing risk as precisely as possible and then having the cure that has been proven to be effective and that can be delivered to the patient, the suffering patient, regardless of what that patient wants, because that is, of course, often the trouble that the suicidal person themselves are at the least ambivalent about receiving or reaching for help.
Thank you. Moving on to the method. You state that the aim of your research was to produce a rich understanding of suicide attempt survivors' perspectives on crisis and healthcare services, and to communicate these findings in ways accessible to relevant audiences, including healthcare professionals and service developers. For this reason, you adopt a pragmatic approach, whereby the epistemological and methodological choices are driven by questions of generating knowledge that is appropriate to the aims of the study, rather than purely methodological appropriateness and fit. So the study design and analysis were primarily influenced by the constructivist-interpretivist paradigm, that is right, given the emphasis of this paradigm in producing contextually bound, deep understandings of the way that the study participants experience and make sense of the phenomenon under study. At the same time, the study admittedly utilizes a post-positivist stance in the sense of attempting to ensure that the knowledge produced is systematically and as objectively as possible so that it is credible, reliable, and generalizable. And indeed, all three publications are written in the style of post-positivist research, with no discussion of your epistemological stance. The discussion is in the summary of the thesis. In the third one, there's a notable change, with the notion of co-construction being central, but there's still no mention of a constructivist epistemological stance in the publication. So I think that the choice of the constructivist interpretivist paradigm is really fitting with the scope and the aim of the study. And I wonder what the addition of post-positivism serves here. I can see how it would make sense, it would make the study more credible in the context of the evidence-based service context that we live in, but I'm not sure it is necessary given the way the wealth of interpretative constructivist work in the clinical field internationally. There's also the personal perspective to consider here, as you reflexively discuss your original professional socialization in post-positivist paradigms, positivist and post-positivist paradigms, before engaging with relational constructivist understandings in clinical practice. So I would like your thoughts about this pragmatic approach and what it serves. From my perspective, the question is why you felt that you needed to complement the constructivist interpretivist paradigm with the post-positivist paradigm. Maybe you can reflexively discuss how you made that choice.
Thank you. I think it's a good phrasing that I felt that I need to. I think this is actually a large part of the answer that this has, of course, been also a personal journey, and I feel in many ways a balancing act. And it is my experience that working as a psychologist in the Finnish Mental Health Service is very much about a balancing act between very different kinds of discourses. And very different kinds of different ways of looking at the service users and what are we trying to do and all of that, and I think that part of what I've been doing in conducting this doctoral research and writing up the articles has been kind of working through that for myself to try to understand kind of the different perspectives that have been in dialogue in my own mind. But I do hope that it has not only been a self-serving endeavor, but there is also kind of the idea, it has been my hope that this, because I think sometimes the problem can be that constructionist research can be conducted and written up in ways that are hard to access if you are not already familiar with that discourse or that world, that way. If you are not, maybe to put it radically, if you are not already kind of indoctrinated in that kind of thinking, it can be very difficult to kind of get into it and for it to have the kind of credibility that you think that there's something to take away from this. So it has been my hope that in writing up this research, that I could do it justice in the sense that I could actually use the constructionist methodology to bring out insights that are rich and kind of open that kind of world, but that I could also kind of package them in an accessible form. And I think that kind of acknowledging the ideas of the post-positivistic paradigm is necessary for that, because that's at least my imagination, that this is what readers will be thinking. They will want answers to these questions. They will want to know who are these 14 of the 104 and where are the other 90... How many is that? who were they and why are they not here and what would they have said? And of course, these are also my questions. So it was important for me to kind of acknowledge that and address that in some ways too. Mm-hmm. Perhaps if I started out now, I would feel less of a need to do so. But
Yeah, I imagine you started from a more positivist, post-positivist, and then along the way you moved to a more constructivist understanding. That was my imagination when I was reading the thesis. But yeah, thank you. Yes, it's a struggle. It's always a struggle. A related issue to this is this regards the status of the concept of co-construction. Co-construction seems to be so pervasive in your study that you include it as a main term in the title, rightly so. You discuss it in the text of the thesis, both with regard to the production of the research material through the interviews and with regard to the relational achievement of recovery through therapeutic interactions. However, it is not mentioned in the first two publications, and co-construction is only included in the third study. Also, the concept of co-construction is in accordance with a constructivist interpretivist perspective, and this is how you explain it in the thesis, but then you seem to also use it from a post-positivist stance in the third article. Now, I'm fully aware that the concept of co-construction is multifaceted and also of the struggle that you just described between the different paradigms. However, since it is a central concept in your thesis, I would like you to comment on how you're conceptualizing and using it in the thesis.
This is a difficult question. I will have to think about all the aspects of it. And it's also perhaps something that I have been aware. There are many, many terms that I have used in the research and in writing it up that have been that have specific meanings in specific kind of discourses, specific traditions, and then it has been there has been much. Well, it has been a struggle at times to kind of decide how much and which aspects of those previous discussions or those traditions should I address if I wish to use a term that has multiple kind of roots or multiple contexts in which it is used. And I think the kind of concept of co-construction, which can also be understood, it can be a concept and then it can also be kind of just a general expression for a phenomenon, kind of a general language thing more so. And I think that's something that I have actually gone, that the latter is what I have been kind of reaching for, that I would not that it's a way to describe what I found in the dates. That's kind of the idea, that what I found, I went in to look at what's happening here, and what I found was this collaboration, co-construction happening, and I think that might explain, at least in part, any kind of lack of I'm looking for the English word. Let's see if I can come up with it. Inconsistency in using the term. I don't know if this answered your question at all.
Well, yeah, the term can be used and has different meanings from a post-positivist paradigm perspective and from an interpretivist perspective. So again, you're trying to weave the two together, and in your answer, it seems you're using my reading, because I'm more on the constructionist side of things. I read it much more as a co-construction of meaning, while you seem to be describing it more in post-positivist terms as describing something that you see there.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Now I think I understand your question better. Also, and that's, to be honest, I don't think I had actually thought of that. I don't think I had at least kind of explicitly realized that it's true. It has been an aim, and this is kind of part of the balancing act, to very much stay on the, in that sense, on the surface, on the observable, kind of to understand, to kind of have an insightful and meaningful interpretation of what is going on, but then also to be very careful to stay with what has been observed, which can, of course, be understood as having this post-positivistic echo, at least. And yes, you are right. I think in that sense, except for the discussion in the summary about the co-construction of the interviews, I think the idea has been that what I'm looking at here is kind of the observable reality, even as it is observed through the accounts, through the telling of the service users.
Thank you. Yes, it is tricky. It is a tricky issue. Okay, moving on. Still in the method, I would like to commend you on the careful consideration of ethical issues. Indeed, doing research with suicide survivors poses a number of ethical concerns. These were very carefully addressed in this study. I would only like to ask you concerning your role in the interview. I understand that your clinical skills and experience, as well as having worked with suicidal individuals, ensured the development of a safe and trusting relationship during the interview. On the other hand, not practicing a SIP and not being involved with the particular services that the participants were receiving were ensuring objectivity and guarding against the danger of double roles. In the interview, you said that before the interview, you introduced yourself to the participants as a clinician as well as a researcher. So I would like you to offer me your thoughts on these various positionings of yourself. And how do you think that these positionings influenced what the participants disclosed during the interviews, and therefore how they influence the findings of your study?
You mean the positioning, that kind of how I introduced myself, the positioning that was transparent or visible to them in the interviews?
Yes, the various positionings, yeah. Both with which you went into the interview and the positionings that the participants put you in through the way you introduce yourself, yeah.
of course, it's perhaps important to say at first that of course, I cannot know. I can only imagine the ways that it has influenced it has influenced the interviews. I was careful to go in with. I introduced myself as a psychologist and told the participants that I was pursuing a doctorate, and this was my doctoral research. But then I tried to emphasize that the point of doing this research, the reason that I am doing this research, is that I want to better understand the perspective of the persons using these services, and that I'm very interested to learn from them. And I was hoping that would maybe perhaps lessen a little bit the tendency or the pressure on the participants to give me answers that I, as a psychologist, or would be expecting. But of course, it does not erase the fact that they know that this is where I'm coming from. I was happy in one of the actually the first interview. Which was one of the longest. We were going on almost 2 hours, I think. And at that point, the interviewees said they were criticizing some services. And then mid-sentence, they stopped and said, I just came to think that I don't really know where you work and whether what I'm saying concerns your work. And I was, of course, happy to hear that for the first 2 hours they had not been thinking about that. But that was also a good reminder that this is what people think about, and of course they orient towards that. I think knowing my own knowing that there is this tension, kind of this possibility that people will be that people's responses will be guided in a significant part by what they perceive as my role being or my expectations being. I try to be during the interviews. I try to communicate in all ways that were possible to me in that situation. Kind of a genuine interest and openness to any experiences that they were sharing. But in the end, as I hope to have also kind of explained or written up in the summary, there is no way of knowing. It was something that interviews were something we were producing together, and they would have been different if somebody else had done them, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Moving on a little bit with the ethics and quality of research. Both in the text of the thesis and in some of the articles, you locate the sections of the quality of the research under the heading of ethics. And also in the text, you make links between the quality of the research process, and specifically validity, and ethical considerations. Now, I know that there is an argument in the qualitative research literature that ensuring quality is an ethical matter, but I would like to hear your views regarding that link. What was your rationale for placing research quality under ethics, and how do you see the two connected in your study?
That's I think, a multifaceted question. I'm trying to make maybe a little bit of bullet points, some list, a small list in my mind. So because I'm noticing that I'm maybe talking on the first bullet point in response to what you're asking.
Can I just add something? It just occurred to me now,
yes,
that in
please.
Most in quantitative research and in positivist research, ethics and quality are two different things. And it's really, as far as I'm aware, in some parts of qualitative traditions where the two are seen as linked. So that's why I was surprised to see them linked in your study, and I was wondering why.
I think there are several reasons for why. I'm noticing now that it feels very natural to me. I'm now maybe having a little bit of trouble explicating kind of the ideas or maybe I'm thinking about what are all the aspects kind of associated with it. But I think, of course, I think it begins with kind of the investment that the investment of the participants is so obvious, of course, to me as a qualitative researcher when I have sat with them through the interviews. And I think probably kind of the core reason of why it would seem difficult to me in my mind to separate the idea of quality and ethics has to do with that, has to do with what I perceive as kind of a duty to the participants. They have invested in this research, shared their story so that it could do some good in the world. They have, many of them explicitly said that they are participating in this research because they want to have their voice heard. They want others to have it better than they had, or they want their voice to matter. They want people in the society at large to understand better their perspective. So I think the first thing is kind of an ethical duty that I perceived that I was given through those interactions to make the best of what they had given me so that their voice could be heard in the ways that they wished that it would be. But then, of course, there's also, I think the other aspect of kind of the link between quality or specifically validity and ethics has to do, and maybe there's, now I'm wondering if it's the post-positivist talking in my mind, that because there is less of the regulation that goes with, have you done the right thing with the numbers? Have you followed the procedure correctly so that these results are not fabricated in that sense? There are less of kind of those obvious kind of objective criteria for whether what we have done in analyzing the data, whether it was scientific, is that a word for here? Whether it did justice to the data, maybe that would be a better way to put it. So I think it's even more kind of important to be aware of that it's not a question of following rules, but rather there needs to be like more of a higher level ethical lens on what are we doing here now when we are analyzing this data and writing this study up, and is it doing justice to the data that we actually have here?
Yes.
I'm hoping that is enough.
Okay, and I'm getting to the issue of sampling, which is a difficult issue here. In terms of sampling, the percentage of eligible participants who actually took part in the study is indeed, as you say, worryingly small. Also, the actual number of participants in a qualitative study at doctoral level is very small. I know it's enough for a regular qualitative study, but usually in doctoral studies we have larger numbers of participants. Now, you treat the problem of low participation percentage as a threat to representativeness in accordance with the post-positivist perspective. And indeed, you get into great lengths to persuasively argue for the representativeness of the sample. Coming myself from an epistemological perspective that ranges between constructivist and constructionist, as I said earlier, my concern about the number of participants, the actual number, and the percentage of participation would be quite different. I would wonder whether there is something in this population that hinders participation in studies generally, and in this particular study specifically, and I would try then to address these issues in order to increase participation or to justify why there isn't participation at the end, after I had address these issues. So I would like to ask you now from, of course, the study is done and completed, but, you know, from the perspective of today, if you see it from this perspective, why do you think there has been such low participation? And is there anything you could have done to mitigate these factors and increase participation?
I think there are... I'm now thinking about from which direction to begin to respond to that. I find myself actually a little bit surprised. Maybe I'll explicate that I find myself a little bit surprised at the perspective that it's as I hear that you are saying that it's kind of an exceptionally low engagement rate. I had not thought that. Of course, I have limited experience doing these kind of studies, but from some feedback, I think one of the reviewers, the kind reviewer of the first paper, I think it was, when I had actually, now it's all coming back to me, I had actually written it up much more apologetically, kind of this both the low percentage of those who were invited into the study, who were participating. Well, actually that, not so much the absolute number. And then the reviewer said that this is a great uptake for this kind of research, that you should not apologize. They did not say that you should not apologize for it, but I thought that was kind of the point. And then I wrote it up again. So I'm a little bit surprised to hear this, but I'm sure it's true, and in that case, I think it has to do with the period also with the characteristics of the group studied. We know that suicidal service users are hesitant to engage with services, and that could be assumed to also. It's possible that they are also more hesitant to engage with research, and also this period when they were invited into the study was, of course, a very fragile period in their life. That it was very soon after the suicide attempt. As to the absolute number of participants being low. Now I'm trying to remember the specific kind of question in that. What can I have a reround of that?
Yeah. No. The effectively, I was asking why you think there was a low participation and what you could have done or how you could have designed the study possibly to have more participation?
That's a good question. I think I was very fortunate to have a great collaboration with the people at Mieli, who I think did a good job at informing the patients about the study and kind of I can imagine that there has not been anything off-putting about the way. Of course, sometimes the invitation to a study can be such that it's very easy to pass it by. Of course, I think the very strict ethical considerations had something to do with it, and it was I emphasized to the actual therapists who were inviting the clients to the study that it needs to be completely voluntary. People cannot be pressured. Not that I would have thought that they would do this, but this is something that was very, very important, kind of for the ethical and. Of course, it's possible to go too far the other way also, so maybe that's something kind of the balancing between ensuring that people are participating voluntarily and then presenting the option to participate in ways that kind of make people more likely to choose that they want to participate. That's maybe the first thing that comes to mind. I'm not sure that I have other quick fixes that come to mind right now about the study design that would have increased participation. I don't know, perhaps promising people movie tickets, which is the standard procedure in Finland. How that affects people's agency for the quantity. When you enter the quantitative research, you often get movie tickets. When I was a psychology student, and I let them put EEG things on my head, which is not easy with my hair, I got movie tickets. So, but maybe not.
Yeah, no, that's not what I had in mind, actually. No, I was thinking more along the lines of, maybe increasing the time of the, data collection, or considering whether, for example, getting participants, doing the interviews closer to the end of the treatment or later would increase participation, things like that, more like, or doing this interview as part, be seen by the participants as a kind of part of treatment. But, there's different ideas. But, okay, yeah, that's... It's kind of after the event, trying to think.
Trying to learn for the next time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm moving on to the studies. What I'd like to do is I have, a kind of commentary of what for each study. Let's see them separately. I have a commentary of what I see in each study, and then you can comment and address questions. It's not so much questions as it's kind of, comment on my thoughts at the end of each study. Yeah, so it's going to be slightly long, each one of them. Not too long. Okay, so the aim of the first study was to achieve an in-depth understanding of service users' views on whether and how services had facilitated or could facilitate their recovery. Given the low to moderate effectiveness of suicide prevention interventions in preventing repeat suicide attempts, asking recipients of these interventions what they found helpful is a very good way of gaining information on what works, how to improve services, and how to foster engagement with services in this population. The findings of this study are very interesting to me. Firstly, what I take from it is, firstly, participants clearly have and are able to articulate personally meaningful recovery goals, as well as the tasks they have set for themselves to achieve these goals. This is a finding in itself, yeah? It is also interesting that the participants primarily evaluated services in relation to whether they helped them in achieving these goals and pursuing their tasks. Yeah, so... Now, the seven elements that, according to participants, were central for services to be helpful are the same as those stressed in most other studies of mental health service users' perspectives. Service users generally value being respected as a human being, being listened to, I'm just, listing your categories, being supported in exploring distressing experiences, continuity of care, collaborative care and decision-making, and comprehensive care that includes the social and familial context. So in that sense, and also effectively, these are the elements of patient-centered and recovery-oriented service delivery. In this sense, this study corroborates pretty much all the previous qualitative studies of mental health service user perspectives on their care. It shows that suicide survivors share the same concerns and preferences for treatment as all the other mental health service users, and that therefore the new perspectives on suicide prevention that are based on patient-centered and recovery-oriented care are appropriate for this population. Yeah? So that's my reading, really, of what I take from that study. So I would like to ask your thoughts on this, and more specifically, how do you think that the links, because you don't make so many links with that kind of more the studies that I just mentioned. So how do you think that the links between your findings and similar findings in other fields of mental health care may be utilized to promote human-centered and recovery-oriented care in suicide prevention? Because I think for me, this is what I take from this study, but it's not really articulated yet.
I think you're completely right that there are many links, and there is nothing kind of nothing novel in the findings in the sense of what has been found. Kind of the idea that you said that as a rule people appreciate even when they go in for somatic reasons. Of course, they appreciate being met by services as human beings and respected. In that sense, of course, there's nothing new about that. I think the reason that I have not made those links more explicitly has been an attempt to keep the whole thing kind of contained in some way. I have made the choice to locate this research very firmly kind of in the suicide literature, in suicidology, in part because I think there are less of those voices in suicidology than there are for example, in the literature concerning psychotic experiences and the treatment of people with those experiences. In hindsight, I think I could have made those links more explicit already in the first. I think they have been kind of they are more present, not very present, but more present in the summary than in that first paper. As to what we could do so that this consensus of service users on kind of their hopes for what service systems would look like would be better accommodated, that's an excellent question. And part of the answer in my mind is that we need to make better use of the expertise of all of the different professions involved in responding to mental health crises. Because I think that right now we have a lot of people with different perspectives working with these people, but then we also have a service system that has one dominant logic, which is the logic of evidence-based medicine, which is as wonderful a logic as the logic of any of the other fields, but it can't do everything. And if everything we do needs to kind of bow to that logic, then we will not be able to make full use of the understanding that we have of these, for example, the interaction components of treatment or the ideas that people are social beings and somehow taking account of that in designing and administering services. It will be difficult if we have to kind of if everything we do needs to kind of be able to be rationalized is not really the word I'm looking for. Let's see if I can find a better synonym in English. If there has to be kind of an evidence-based medicine argument for those things, it will hinder us from doing them. And then if we have more freedom for the different perspectives to work together, I think we will do a better job of actually delivering what service users need. And I think that this is, it's very much a problem of implementation, because in Finland, in the healthcare service system, for example, in the city of Helsinki, where I have worked for a long time before, previously in the psychiatric services, recovery-oriented, the idea is that what we are doing is recovery-oriented practice, and there's a lot of good ideas kind of brought in to that system, and kind of the consensus in many ways of what we are doing is fairly congruent, I think, with these findings and with recovery-oriented ideas more generally, but then putting them to practice in that system, which is, again, dominated by the logic and the procedures that have to do with well, it's a struggle.
That's another struggle, yes, yeah. I know. Yes. And one particular point around study one that I wanted to discuss is regarding exploring and making sense of distressing experiences. Because you have make a comment in the publication of the first study that the demand for exploration of the suicidal act may be considered as a need specific to this population. And from what I have read in the relevant literature, the more broadly psychiatric literature, the need to explore and make sense of distressing experiences has been consistently articulated by psychiatric service users. The strongest example is engaging with voices and making sense of them in the Hearing Voices network. And typically, professionals do not engage with these experiences, mainly because they see them within the medical model as meaningless symptoms. If I understand correctly, exploring the suicide attempt is discouraged in standard professional practice, not only because within the medical model, suicide attempts are considered symptoms of a disorder, but also because it might be too distressing for professionals. So I wonder what your thoughts are on this topic. Were you surprised that the suicide survivor participants find exploration of their recent suicide attempt helpful? Why do you think the exploration of suicide attempts is discouraged by professionals? And do you think this should change, that exploration should take place, and generally or under what conditions would it be helpful or not helpful?
Okay. I will try to make a mental note of the three questions. Why is it helpful? Why is it... No, I already lost them.
No, it's
can
okay.
Can you please repeat? I will take my pen and paper. And
oh, no, it's why do you think it's discouraged by professionals? I mean, that you've already answered pretty much in your thesis already. But so we kind of know why it's discouraged. But my question is, were you surprised by finding that the participants found that helpful? And so do you think that should take place more? And under what conditions?
Okay, now I will be able to remember if I can read my handwriting. It's a difficult question whether I was surprised. In some sense I was, and in another sense I wasn't. But I think maybe the best answer is that the participants themselves were also surprised. We shared this surprise that it's not an easy task. It's not an easy task for professionals, but it's not also easy for the service users themselves. And even though they emphasized that it's important, it was not something that they were very eager to do or that was unproblematic or it was actually a very complicated matter. And I think that was something that for me was very impressive about OSSIP, about the attempted suicide short intervention program that the participants had gone through, and that was very impressive for them. OSSIP seemed to make that task of kind of looking right at, quite of course quite concretely in OSSIP, you look at the video of the person's first, the OSSIP clients first tell the story of their suicide attempt. It is videotaped, and then they watch it together, the video on the second session of OSSIP, so it's very concrete. But it seemed that the program of OSSIP was very effective in facilitating that difficult task, the task that these participants found both difficult and important. And I'm not sure that all of them would have thought that it was important beforehand, that it's important to remember that I was interviewing them after they had gone through OSSIP. And at that point, all of them said that this is very important, this should be done, it should not be it should not be skipped. And some of them had had that thought before ASIP. Some of them had been frustrated by interactions before ASIP in which they felt that professionals kind of tried to just hop over the suicide attempt and just like, let's move on now and let's, you know. But some of them went into ASIP being quite hesitant or ambivalent. Of course, those who were most opposed to the idea would likely not have entered ASIP at all. So there's also likely people for whom the barrier or threshold to do that kind of work is even higher. Okay, so that's the answer to was I surprised. Then the other question was, should it happen more and under what conditions? Yes, it should happen more. That's an easy question. And I think the conditions, here I'm torn because I'm worried that now if I will explicate kind of the ideal conditions, then we will end up in the situation where I think we are often now in Finnish healthcare, because especially during crises, there are many professionals involved. Often the continuity of care is not great. And even when there is kind of sufficient services, there are many different professionals engaged in that, and the person can meet one person at the emergency services one day, and then the next day they're in inpatient care, and there are other people there that they're working with, and then they're there for 3 days, and then they go to, then there's some in-between kind of service checking on them, which all were appreciated by these people. They appreciated people checking up on them, even if it wasn't the kind of ultimate place where they would be cared for. And then, of course, the question of who should do it and when is the time to pause and do this work is difficult. And ideally, of course, it would be so that there is like one person or a few people that do this work with the service user. But then I think it's a bigger mistake to wait for that. I think it's a bigger mistake, for example, during inpatient care, to just think that, okay, let's not open this theme here because you will only be here for a couple of days, so you can talk about it, then you will have the more long-term treatment relationship somewhere else. So, because I think this is often the thought in inpatient care, and that's definitely something I have struggled with when I have worked as a psychologist in contexts in which I've had very short contact with participants, that what are the things that we go into right now and what are the things for later. Okay, so yes, it should happen more. Ideally, there would be a context similar to ASIP to have at least a few sessions to kind of pause on that. And then, of course, there needs to be some kind of going back to that in the beginning of a new treatment relationship also. A lot of the participants said that they had used that because they had their own, they called it their own story written that they got from ASIP, kind of a summary of the suicidal narrative, that they had taken it and given it to the next professional, so it was kind of carried over these gains. Ideally, there would be less of those transfers, but I think it's more important to not skip the work, even if we do have the transfers.
Yeah, just a commentary that came to mind with this last comment of yours, that some took the narrative to further, and I think it would be worth using narrative ideas there, in the sense that the idea of owning, you know, not only developing, you develop your own narrative that you then collaborate with a professional, but then you own that narrative. That's practiced a lot also in the Hearing Voices network, where people, with the help of someone else, voice hearers, end up with a narrative of their, an explanation of their voice hearing that they can then own and carry on with them and continue working on it. So that's an interesting idea. Okay, I'm moving on to the second study. Now, here, you will bear with me because it's kind of, I saw the two studies, really, the first and the second related. So let me develop a little bit my thinking about it, and then I'll I can repeat the questions after.
Thank you.
So, okay. So study two focused on participants' evaluation of the ASIP program that they had just completed shortly before. It's worth mentioning and keeping in mind that ASIP is based to a large extent on the principles of patient-centered and recovery-oriented care. I don't know if it does so explicitly, if it says so, but reading it, I saw all these principles there. Yeah. So this should be kept in mind when discussing the findings of this study, the second study, because effectively the participants who had experience both of treatment as usual and ASIP were asked to evaluate both of them in the same interview. And effectively what they did is what would be expected, and this is what they did, is they used their experience of one intervention, mainly ASIP, which was a positive experience, to articulate what the helpful elements of care are, and then evaluated treatment as usual on the basis of this. Yeah, so it's like the findings of the two studies, I think, are very connected because of the context of the interview. Yeah, so the elements of ASIP that participants found helpful are once again very similar to the principles of recovery-oriented practice. Those that stand out as the most important for all participants are, firstly, the establishment of a therapeutic relationship, that of course includes trust, respect, active listening. You know, I'm linking it back to the seven elements of the study one. Second, exploration of the suicidal act that corresponds to the more general demand of service users for making sense of distressing experiences. And third, safety planning that goes back, is linked to collaborative care. So that on the other hand, the two aspects of ASIP that were found, or rather the two aspects in which ASIP was found lacking, were firstly not seeing through participants in their recovery journey, in other words, not providing enough continuity of care. That's the way I read it, at least. And secondly, not including in the treatment the user's social and familial environment. Now, in the discussion of the second study, you link the two, you try and link the findings of the two studies, yeah? Participants' evaluation of ASIP and the participants' evaluation of other services. And you say that from the seven elements of care that participants found helpful, four were consistently reported as being present in ASIP. Yeah? So that was the experience of being valued, support in exploring suicidality, support in exploring making meaning of their experiences, and psychological continuity and predictability. Yeah, these were the four elements that were present in ASIP. And then you say that two of the seven were not relevant to ASIP, and that is responsiveness to client needs and involving clients in medication decisions. And one element of the seven, accounting for clients' relationship context, were found lacking in both treatment as usual and ASIP. Okay, I'm just reminding you this because I actually disagree with that evaluation of the two studies. Because in my view, responsiveness to client needs is characteristic of ASIP. At least I saw it in the description of ASIP. And also, if you broaden the element of involving client, one of the seven elements was involving clients to medication decisions. But if you broaden that to mean involving clients in treatment decisions, which is effectively collaborative care, that is also an element of ASIP in the broader sense. Yeah? So, on the other hand, I'm not sure that ASIP provides adequate continuity of care in the sense that it provides psychological continuity within the program and in the short space of the program, but then it doesn't provide continuity after that or kind of link with other services. So in that sense, yeah, these are my thoughts, that actually I kind of thought differently about the links between the two studies. And I wonder whether, if there was a stronger connection with the literature on service user perspectives on care generally, and a stronger connection with patient-centered and recovery-oriented professional practices and services, whether you had had a better connection there, then that would allow you to translate terms from one study to the other. And so I know earlier you said that you try to restrict yourself and focus on suicidology research, but I do think that if you had located this study in the broader context of service users' experiences and patient-centered recovery-oriented care, that would have allowed you the theoretical framework to translate concepts. Translate what they say, the participants say, to the theory, to theoretical concepts, and then transpose them from one study to the other. And also, I think that locating this study in the broader recovery-oriented movement would also allow you to have a stronger, effectively promote the implementation through recommendations while you have the backup of the whole kind of broader literature and movements. But for that, we'll talk about that when we get to the implementation later. But at the moment, these were my thoughts, really. That so I wonder what you think about my reinterpretation of your findings. But more generally, I think it's an issue of linking it up to the theory of recovery and patient-centered care.
I don't disagree. I think it's true that there could have been a lot of benefits in linking it to that literature. I think there were also benefits to finishing this project at some point in my life. So that's, I think that would be my response to that. Perhaps those are next steps I could think. But then I do have a clarification for kind of I do have a defense for what I have done with the interpretation of the findings that you were summarizing from study two, and I will take your comments as a critique, perhaps for not explicating apparently not explicating well enough kind of the logic behind that interpretation. In kind of looking at which of the seven elements OSIP fulfilled or kind of covered, I was taking the perspective of what were the service users expecting from OSIP, which is supposed to be a brief intervention, because there's this idea that OSIP is not supposed to do from the perspective of the developers of OSIP, but also from the perspective of OSIP's users. I think that was one finding that was both surprising to me and important, that the service users, even though they protested kind of the lack of continuity of care, that very few of them in any way kind of expressed that OSIP being a short intervention and not kind of then evolving into other kinds of care within that same frame, it was not problematic for them. They found that this was something that had a clear idea for some. It was part of the reason that they were willing to enter OSIP, that, okay, it's only three times, I can maybe do that, especially because they're promising me that I can come in one time and then decide if I want to come in again. Many of them were quite hesitant about, they were afraid that they would be that they would have to commit to long-term care and were hesitant about that and found it important that there was available this short intervention. And here we are now coming to my defense, which is that, let me try to remember, they felt that it was important that in OSSIP there was the two-year follow-up, and they felt that OSSIP was in itself continuous enough. Then they protested that, okay, now I'm emerging from OSSIP with a clarified understanding of what I need to work on, and I am expecting these other services. For most of them, it was psychiatric outpatient care. They were enrolled there, and they were expecting, in my mind, this was kind of a very justifiable expectation that, okay, these services will now help me work on this stuff. It's not the job of OSSIP, it's the job of these other services. And then they were frustrated if that did not happen. So that was the logic there. And then there is in Finland the attempt to include the loved ones in OSSIP, but that's a clear implementation issue that none of these participants had taken that up, that even though the idea is there, there needs to be more thinking about how to actually make it happen.
Yeah, I think the two elements missing from OSSIP, in my sense, continuity of care, not in the sense of OSSIP itself continuing their care, but of having better links and referrals to the other services that would continue care, that's something that OSSIP needs to think about. And the second is, making more active efforts of including the loved ones. Because it's one thing if you say that they might, if they want, they could bring in their loved ones in the fourth session, as far as I remember, but clearly more attention needs to be paid into encouraging people to bring in their loved ones. So that's, yeah. So in that sense, there's very clear, which we're going to get later, very clear recommendations can come out of this study regarding both FACIP and other such interventions. Okay, study three. I don't have as much to say about study three, so that's okay. So the third study, explores the recovery-related agency of suicide attempt survivors and the perceived role of interactions with services in facilitating or hindering it. This, in my view, is the most innovative part of the thesis. The results highlight the complex and multifaceted nature of agency and its inextricable relationship with professional practices. It is interesting how the professional practices that participants described as promoting their agency are pretty much the same as those identified earlier as helpful elements of their recovery. So you can see how all these are connected. I find very interesting the discussion of the findings in relation to Bandura's individual proxy and collective agency. And this, seeing it as proxy agency, the concept of a proxy agency shows the creativity and the active stance of service users in figuring out ways to get to coach professionals and services to support them in pursuing their recovery goals. The link with self-determination theory is also very interesting, showing how the interplay between autonomy, relatedness, and competence can be both theoretically enhanced by the concept of agency and how they can all be supported through appropriate professional practices. Now, in my view, the innovativeness in this study lies in three things: demonstrating the co-construction of service user agency in service settings, stressing the crucial role of professionals in supporting recovery-related agency, and finally, and most importantly, alerting professionals to the flexible and responsive way that they have to operate in order to promote client agency. So these are my thoughts. It's a complex study, and it really has something very new to say about agency, the relationship between agency, recovery, and what professionals can do to promote recovery-related agency. So I would like to hear what you think about your study, what might have surprised you in this study, whether you learned something you had not thought about before here, and also the conclusions you derive from this study.
Now I need my pen again.
Okay.
Let's see.
Can
you repeat?
Yes. What you have learned really from this study, whether you learned something you didn't expect or didn't know. I think that's the main thing. What did you come out with yourself from this study? What did you learn?
Thank you for that question and for your kind words. I think you had your first question, what do you think about this study? And I was going to say that I'm proud of it. I'm happy with that study. It's the one I struggled with the most. It was also, I think, the big surprise for me was during the interviews. It was not kind of not so much perhaps in the process of actually doing that part of working on study three, but rather that when I was doing the interviews, this was what surprised me and kind of also excited me about the interviews was the window, which was new, and that was of course what I was looking for when I went into this research. I wanted to better understand what's going on in the minds of service users. It's a different perspective when I'm the professional. I had, of course, I had tried to kind of engage my patients in conversations about how is what we're doing here working out for you, you know, the idea, but it's a different kind of perspective when they are, when in those interviews, they were narrating completely from their own perspective what was going on. And I think I was very surprised and also impressed by the kind of the sheer amount of labor that they put into their engagement with services, kind of the work that they were doing to get the help that they needed, and then in some cases to protect themselves from what was experienced as harmful or harmful responses in one way or another. So I was very impressed kind of by what that, I was so grateful to have that window and very impressed by what it was showing me. And that was kind of the first thing that I was really intrigued about in the interviews. Well, then we decided to kind of write up the first two pieces first because I also thought that it's the most complex, it's the most difficult to kind of do justice to how can I kind of this finding that's here, that this is how these people talk about these interactions, how can that be kind of turned into a research paper that would be useful to somebody. So then I got back to it after I had written up the first two papers, and that was a good choice, I think, in many ways, because of course my own thinking had evolved, and I had learned a lot in writing the first two pieces. And then maybe the most important kind of learning journey then when I was actually doing the work, analyzing that data from that perspective, and then writing up the report. Was kind of trying to get some kind of handle on the aspects of agency, and of course that's another concept with so many uses and so many definitions, and kind of trying to understand what it's doing here. And what I think what I'm happy about is that I think I'm not sure if anybody would agree. I'm interested to hear from the audience if some of them have actually opened the book and read that thing. But what I think was
what I'm proud of is that I think that the result is kind of pretty simplistic in some ways, that it's a simple kind of simple idea that's there, kind of that the concept of agency that I had found very complex and very difficult to in some way, both intriguing and difficult to engage with. What I'm hoping that has been done there, at least in my mind, it's kind of been broken down into more accessible aspects or parts in some ways, and it's helped me as a professional to think about the work that we do a lot. So I'm hoping it will do that for some other people too.
Yes, it's not that. Don't think it's simplistic at all. I mean, it's really good how all this complexity, which is there in the paper, of the notion of agency and the notion of recovery and what professionals can do, is kind of put into this scheme of the four. The scheme seems simple, but it actually, you know, it kind of condenses very complex material, and I think it's a good guide for professionals in terms of how they should be dealing with agency and in the service of recovery. Okay, so towards the end, moving to the discussion. I would like to commend you on the very articulate, systematic and informed way you have structured the discussion of the thesis. I absolutely agree with your evaluation of the problems and adverse effects that the dominance of the medical model and the corresponding evidence-based practice and evidence-based medicine have brought to mental health practice generally, and suicidology in particular. And I agree with you that it is misfortunate that psychology did not exert the influence it could as a central mental health profession in rebalancing the clinical and research perspectives in a more psychosocial direction. I can see how the emphasis on adopting a post-positive perspective in your published work might be necessitated by that dominance. However, other perspectives are gaining ground, as you describe. So how do you think, my question is, how do you think you might be able to foster a shift towards How do you think we might be able to foster a shift towards more person-oriented and psychosocially oriented clinical research? And how did you try to do it in your work?
Do you mean my work as a psychologist or in this work?
This work.
That's an excellent question. I have to say, for my part, it's a really, really difficult question, and one I have spent a lot of time reflecting on kind of trying to understand what the problem is, why it's so difficult, because of course we have a lot of agreement, a lot of consensus, also across the professions about the important aspects of, for example, mental health care. And I find that often it's actually a little bit difficult. It's frustrating and it's difficult to understand why they are not better, kind of manifested in what we do. That I think there is actually very little. In anything I have written that anyone would disagree with, but perhaps the disagreement is as to, I mean, in kind of the finding that it's important to, I don't think anybody disagrees with medicine as a science, definitely does not disagree with the idea that it's important to treat service users or patients as human beings and respectfully and so on and so forth. But of course, the relative emphasis that's given to the different aspects of care varies, and I think it's not really... I think also sometimes kind of medicine gets the blame unfairly. It's not really their job. I think the problem is that we're not dividing labor as well as we could. That we have these different fields of science because there are different important questions, for example, in suicide prevention or in mental health that we need to address. And then what we need is dialogue between the experts. And then how we can achieve that is try. I don't know. I'm trying today. I've been trying in writing these papers. I know there are a lot of other people trying. Of course, it would help, as was stated in my opening statements, that it would help to have sufficient resources for mental health work, because a lot of kind of I think we retreat to more authoritative and more kind of simplistic and more of a strict kind of medical model kind of thinking when we're kind of pushed for resources and we don't feel safe as professionals, we're uncomfortable as professionals, and then it becomes kind of more of a nuisance that service users actually have their own point of view and their intentional subjects that come into contact with us, and we can't go around that, and when we're in a hurry, we want to go around that because we know what's good for them, and we want to kind of skip the part where we need to form a mutual understanding of what needs to happen. So that's one big part of it. So in summary, let's try to have dialogues. Of course, I'm hoping that people from different professions will engage in that dialogue. There's work to be done within the professions and then across kind of the boundaries. And then we need more resources to make it easier. It's much easier to have dialogues if you're not in a horrible hurry.
I don't know how much time. Do we have a little bit more time? We're okay. Now I'll go through the different topics that you mentioned in your discussion. The recognition of relationality as being at the heart of both the development of mental health problems, including suicidality, and the recovery from them, is pointed out in the second section of the discussion. This points to the need for services to take into account and support the service users' relational contexts. So what would the recommendations be from this study regarding strengthening the services' inclusion of user social contexts and relationships? Do you have more? I know you discuss it, but would there be more specific recommendations that you can get from the study?
That's a good question. I have steered clear in the discussion mostly of very specific recommendations, because I think that what works, kind of how those ideas can be put to work, is so contextual that and the Finnish service system is such that there's a lot going on, and how to implement that has to be kind of put into happen in relation to the context of existing services. One simple recommendation, of course, is that in ASIP, it's wonderful that there's the option to bring loved ones along, but there needs to be more of a push. This is the participants' words. There needs to be more of a push towards it. Of course, it's voluntary, but there are different ways to help people kind of overcome that challenge that they perceived inviting their loved ones along being. So perhaps for the audience it's important to explicate that many of the participants said that they thought it would have been important. They were worried about their loved ones. There were conflicts and things going on there that they thought would be important to address, but that there was kind of, it felt difficult to invite the loved ones along for and one reason for this was that they kind of wanted to protect them at the same time as they wanted to engage with them and so forth. So that's kind of a simple, specific recommendation. Well, then we have in Finland, I think there is much opportunity because we have the current situation in Finland is such that we have kind of a fairly good infrastructure and a developing infrastructure for providing psychotherapy in mental health. But then we have this overwhelming dominance of the individual. We have this idea. We do not have the idea that people can be treated in couples relationships or in family relationships. We are pushing everybody toward individually focused interventions, resulting in those interventions being backed up and people having to wait. And then we have a reserve of professionals who are specifically skilled in working with couples and families. We have couples and family therapists who are very much underused in the current system. So by kind of thinking about locally, thinking about how can we kind of engage with that expertise, with that, how can we make better use of the people that we already have here in Finland that are experts in that? How can we make better use of that? And we also have kind of the infrastructure for that. What we need is for the idea of it's possible to address mental health problems through relationships, that treatment does not need to focus only on what's happening in the mind or the brain of the service user. And that's where I think we need to look outside kind of the very strict EBM frame, in the sense that that's, I think, a big part of the problem, a big part of why we are not making good use at this moment of these interventions, is that there's a tension there, that it's difficult when the diagnosis is put on the individual. It's difficult then to make the recommendation to work on changing that through a relational treatment. Yes. I don't know if I have anything to add to that.
Okay, and the other two topics that you address in the conclusions, one is service integration, continuity of care, both within services and, you know, integration, creating pathways between services that ensure continuity of care. This is a big issue in mental health service literature. It's something that's pointed out again and again by the participants. So I wonder whether your research can lead to specific recommendations on that. And the other is the agency issue. Again, you show how complicated the issue of agency is and how important the role of professionals is for constructing agency, recovery-oriented agency. So again, I suppose more generally, my question is, have you thought about, can you think of any recommendations that would relate to these two topics, continuity of care and agency? And more generally, I suppose the question is, do you intend to, as the next steps, work towards translating the findings into more concrete guidelines, recommendations for practice?
I'm waiting for an invitation to do so. So anyone in the audience working on national projects can call me. Let's see. We'll see. We'll see about that. Of course, that's the hope. The hope is that these service users' voices and this work could affect what we actually do in responding to suicidal service users. As it comes to recommendations, of course, it's not a novel finding that we have problems with the continuity of care. I think it's very much something that anyone working in mental health services in Finland, or anyone who has tried to use them, could have reported. I think what the kind of valuable perspective perhaps provided by this this research was kind of putting some on elaborating kind of on the process of because there's then also a big discussion in Finland and internationally on the role of brief interventions and their value and whether they're and how they would best be used and kind of the point that I try to make there in the discussion is that it's very important that we have that many of these interventions can be very useful, I suppose clearly useful in this context, but if we only look at that, then we will run into trouble. We will invest in things that will not kind of pan out. They will not have the intended results. I'm happy. It is my understanding, I worked for a little bit, there's this large-scale development project in Finland going on, first-line therapies, where the idea is to bring more of these brief interventions into the healthcare system, but also the very important idea that is, at least the idea is there, and I'm hoping that it will also be realized in all of the implementation, is that there are processes for ensuring the continuity of care, that the big change is actually that after we do something with the service user, then we check that did it help or do you need more help, and then we kind of give more help if people need it, whereas in the current circumstances it's we do something and then we assume it perhaps helped, and then we assume that the person contacts services again and goes through the whole thing again if they need to. Okay, let me try to get back to what I was saying. Okay, so we need to kind of try to make that a central idea of service design. What I think is perhaps a small but concrete recommendation that can be made based on this research is that, and what was a surprise to me and which is encouraging, is that very small gestures could have a very important meaning. And like I emphasize here, it's not so much about the continuity of care. Of course, it's nice if it's not so many people and so many places, but actually the psychological continuity of care is not the same as the actual continuity in the real world, and there was much to be done to enhance the psychological continuity of care even in the current kind of little bit of a chaotic system. And the little things, kind of calling to check up on, okay, we referred you to this service, did you go there? And are things now kind of proceeding there? Was very much appreciated and could very much make the difference. And after discharge from hospital, if somebody called to check up on a person who was waiting for the next thing to start, that could make a really big difference. So I think that's something that we can kind of very easily capitalize on, making those calls. Okay, now, then I had another question to respond to, so that's probably enough for question number one. Question number two was recommendations for prioritizing the perspective of service user agency better. There, I think, again, as you can see, I'm a big believer in the power of ideas. it's my idea. Also, it's my hope that that not everything, for example, resulting from this research, needs to be packaged into kind of now I'm again looking for the word. Let's see. That it doesn't need to be kind of a ready-to-use recommendation, but I have a lot of trust in the agency of people listening and into people working in these services, that also just kind of prioritizing, that if I can make the point that this idea needs to be prioritized, then people will have good ideas on how to implement that in practice. Maybe that's kind of the hope. When it comes to agency, I think there's a lot that we can do in how we train professionals especially in suicide prevention, which is of course the field here. We have suicide prevention training traditionally emphasizes the role of the professional a lot about what to do, about risk assessment, and then what interventions to kind of deliver to the patient and what are the correct steps for the professional to take. And there I think we need a shift in emphasis, and that's something that's already happening, I think, but we need more of a shift in emphasis to kind of helping professionals accept the fact that they have to work with the person's agency, that there is no shortcut, that however much we may want to coerce people into wanting to live with the best of intentions, we cannot do that. Under the Finnish mental health law, we can keep people safe for short periods of time in specific situations, regardless of their own intentions, but those are very short periods of time, and if we want people to live their whole lives, we need to somehow engage with their own agency. We need to support them to form the intentions and acquire the power to keep living and keep themselves safe. And I think that kind of bringing that idea more to the forefront in training professionals would help professionals relate to service users in more agency-promoting ways. And I also think it's a win-win, because I think it's also easier to do this work if you kind of surrender to that idea that we're working with intentional human beings, and even in suicide prevention, it's not my job to be an omnipotent authority that comes in and fixes the situation. That it's not a role that's kind of available. That it's I don't need to play that role, and I cannot play that role. That it's enough to kind of engage with the person and try to look for the way forward together with them. I think it makes our work less stressful and more meaningful. So I'm hoping to spread that idea.
Thank you. I can see your argument or your stance that, you know, you don't want to have specific recommendations, and you're not in a position to have specific recommendations from the position of the researcher. But I do think, given the novelty of this study in the Finnish context, and the applicability, you know, the kind of that it's an applied study that has very direct repercussions for practice, it would be worth, I mean, I would urge you to, you know, maybe in collaboration with ASIP or Mieli or other services, it would be a worthy next step to get to translate this, the findings of this study, into more specific guidelines for good practice. You know, so that would be something I would recommend that you do as a next step. But now a more kind of last question, which is, if you were able to do this study again, what would you change? And what, like after the event, looking at it, what have you done differently? What would you have done differently?
I would not have transcribed the interviews myself. I think that was the most difficult and frustrating and exhausting part of the research process. Of course, it was also a good way to really immerse myself in the data, but I would not have done that. I did it because it would have been, I thought at the time that it would have been more of a hassle, because I didn't think of including in the, when I was applying for the ethical approval and all that, I didn't think to kind of put it in there that there will be somebody transcribing them other than me, and then I thought it's a bigger work to go over that again. So I have learned that. On perhaps a more important note, I think what I have regretted most during this research process is not applying in the beginning for permission to contact the participants after words to not. It would have been wonderful to have the chance to re-engage with them, perhaps for some form of kind of member checking, for some form of presenting the results to them and hearing their ideas on that. And then also, of course, another but related idea would have been kind of a follow-up interview. I had the fantasy at the time that a lot of this was also kind of a lot of the participants offered they made spontaneous offers that you can contact me and I'll be happy to engage in more of this kind of research and so on. And then it was a little bit of a surprise to me that the system was so unflexible it was not possible to do that. So that's something that if I went back now to beginning this research, that I would kind of include that in the paperwork that was sent in for review and that I received the permissions for. I think those are the biggest things. Then there's a lot of little things, maybe more to do with the process. But I'm also quite happy with
what
I've done.
That's not very many, so you were overall happy with it, content with the process. Okay, I think I am ready to make the final statement. Yes? Okay. Sorry. This way. I have now completed the oral examination of the candidate and am satisfied with the responses provided by Selma in our discussion. As is evidenced in both the thesis itself and the oral examination that took place today, Selma has displayed proficiency in both the theoretical background and her chosen method of analysis. She was able to navigate quite diverse and complex theoretical literature to present complicated concepts and debates in a clear yet nuanced manner and to provide an accessible account to a wider readership. The way she has analyzed and interpreted the research material is thorough and thoughtful. She has made excellent use of qualitative research to systematically highlight the suicide survivor perspectives on what helps them in the services that they receive, producing significant knowledge that can be used for the development of effective suicide prevention services. Based on this, I present the thesis to the faculty for approval, and I would like to congratulate you.
Thank you very much for this interesting discussion. And for all your comments, remarks. Thank you.
Welcome.
It's your first. You end it first, and then I say coffee.
No, you should ask.
Oh, I should ask. You can't end it yet. Oh no. Okay, we have rehearsed these lines a lot, but still we don't remember them. Let's see. I need to look up. I'm so happy I survived, but now I find that I have not yet survived. Okay. I solicit those people who have some critical comments regarding my thesis to ask for an address from the kustos.
Väitöstilaisuus on päättynyt.
Kiitoksia, kun olitte kuulemassa. Kahvia löytyy tuolta aulan puolelta. Tulkaa kahville ja kuohuvalle. Kiitoksia ja kiitos etänä myös seuranneille. Toivon, että teilläkin on kahvia.